Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the Indian Religions Podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Giri Ifergan, who is at Monash University in Australia. He researches Indian philosophy and Tibetan Buddhism. We'll be talking about his brand new Equinox book, The Psychology of the Yogas. Giri, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this is a fascinating topic. Can you tell us how you got down the road of researching this? What's the backstory of this research?
Yeah, the backstory goes to somewhere at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, I came across a book by Jack Kornfeld. And the title of the book is After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. Although the catchy kind of title, I was fascinated by some of the content of the book. And the contents of the book was testimonies of people, Western people mostly, who spent years in India, in Tibet, at the Himalayas with yogis, with gurus, and practice for years, yoga and meditation. And they have reported touching on the peaks of meditation, which is boundless love and compassion and lucidity and clarity and visions, basically the peak of meditation. But then in the testimonies in the book, most of them have mentioned that when they came back to the West, they have experienced serious psychological crisis, whether it was with their health, with money, with relationship, with family, a professional career, etc. So I asked myself, where is the spiritual promise? Because the spiritual promise is that if you only follow this kind of path and you will attain this kind of mental state, it means that psychologically you will be free. And you will be, in a way, diluting or maybe even resolving all notions of suffering in one's life. So that was the first road sign that or bulb that was lit in my mind. Later on, I met a friend of mine from Israel who's a naturopath that for a few decades participated in Vipassana retreats. And he saw time and again the same people coming to the retreat. And if it wasn't the same people, so people of the same, of a similar character that he could recognize that came to the retreat. Then when I asked him whether he witnessed any radical transformation, like spiritual, like the spiritual promise tells us about. And then he said, no, he didn't see anyone that has gone through a radical transformation. Although people had insight and introduced some changes into their life, which is beautiful and wonderful in that sense, that meditation was conducive to their life. He said he didn't witness any radical change. But what really broke the camel's straw was I came across an article by Jack Engler, who's a psychologist from Harvard, who worked with Dan Brown on a survey that was attending people who've gone into practice of Vipassana for 3 months, on a retreat for 3 months. So they have conducted Rorschach's survey with the practitioners before and after. And he also noticed any major change psychologically that took place within the existence of the practitioners, the day-to-day life. And his conclusion was striking. He was saying problems of anger, jealousy, depression, all these occur in relationship, and they should be resolved in relationship. Sitting on the cushion is not enough. So this has driven me to ask, what yoga and meditation offer us in terms of a psychological framework to understand the human psyche, and what practice they provide us to address psychological issues, and how we could implement it. That was my motivation for the.
There's so much that comes to mind, and anecdotally, in terms of various spiritual seekers and coaching conversations and courses that I've been involved in. I'll maybe save some of the comments for later on in the podcast. Tell us in a nutshell for the listener, what is the core takeaway argument thesis? What is the book essentially arguing?
The book is saying that when you look into the ancient texts of yoga, like the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, so Patanjali offers a very profound psychological framework for understanding the human psyche, really profound. And not only that aside from meditation, from asana, rituals, or cultivating moral rules or instructions of being as a way of being, Patanjali offer that framework, not only the theory, but also the practice that can aid us to resolve or dilute psychological matters that we experience in our life. So that was my main argument. And then I was saying that in regard to the practice is limited to the person in a way. Limited, I'm saying, with some limited guarantee, to the person in the cave. So I had to bring this practice and make it accessible to the 21st century practitioner. So that was a big step in my work. And then I was saying, look, this practice is designed to work for the long, long run of time. And in India, in Indian philosophy, when you speak about time, the time has time. We speak about reincarnations. We speak about a long duration of time beyond our cycle of life, and then personal cycle of life. So I ask myself, what Western psychology can offer us when we cannot really resolve issues with the aid of what Patanjali offers us, for example? Because until I will reach these peaks of meditations or resolving my psychological issues through the aid of yoga, until then, I don't want to hurt the people I love. I don't want to hurt my people in my professional environment. I don't want to hurt myself and emotionally and psychologically. So what can I do? So then I make a shift to Western psychology, showing how Western psychology can help us resolving in the short term, some psychological issues that can be complementary of yoga and help to integrate our psychology with our spirituality.
So would you say
round? Yeah,
sure. Would you say that your work is, in essence, a bridge between yogic psychology and Western psychology, or would you say that's too simplistic a characterization?
No, my aim wasn't to create a bridge, because to create a bridge, I'll have to go through a huge process of a study, which we'll have to compare between Western psychology. And Western psychology has so many method and streams and so intra criticism between the various streams that it would be very difficult to just in one chapter to compare between the two. So my aim was to see what I can learn, in Western psychology that can assist me on my yogic path. And it's not by way of synthesis or bridging or synthesis, but just looking at something else and look what I can use there. It's like the what we call naturopathy or homeopathy and modern medicine. So, you know, sometimes you go for maintenance to see a homeopath or a Chinese doctor, while basically we will resort to Western medicine. So it wasn't a synthesis or a bridge, just what I can learn from momentarily in a point of time, what can I can do to cure psychological issues and then continue with my meditation and yoga.
So perhaps a complementarity where, as you, to use your metaphor, that there are times where alternative paradigms might complement a Western medical paradigm. There's sort of a complementarity between some aspects of Western psychology and with respect to integrating the vision of the yogic quest, yes?
Yes, yes. This is my point.
Yes. Now, would you say, for those listening, is this book particularly geared towards seekers, Indologists, psychologists? You know, just who would you say is the prime audience for the book?
Yeah, this is the book. Has a very strict work of scholarship where I relate to classic commentator, modern commentator, to the text, various texts like the Yoga Sutra, the Samkhya Karika. So it has a scholar a profound aspect of it, in my view. There is which include also a deep interpretation of the yogic psychological practice of Praktipaksha Bhavana, which means practicing or meditating on the opposite. And as such, it refers or offers practitioners of yoga and teachers of yoga a whole method how to work with their own psychology and to understand their own psychology and move forward. It can also assist therapists and psychologists who are interested to learn what yoga can offer in that sense and how to borrow it or use it. It's up to them. And what I wanted to show that yoga is much more than just the asana you see in, or yogic physical yoga that you see today in so many studios. It is much more than the history and the philosophy. It has also this psychological framework. So as such, I approach a wide audience. And here I may be in a problem because scholars will say, as a practitioner, you are too close to your object of research. And hence you cannot be that objective or you don't have that too much of a reflective, you know, reflective point of view. And practitioners would say that I may be too intellectual, highbrow kind of intellectual, and relate too much to the scriptures, and basically everything is but an experience. So, and psychotherapists would be saying, "Hey, you are talking about psychology, but what makes you qualified to speak about psychology?" So I'm a scholar and I read psychology articles in psychology journals, and I can read and understand and consult friends who are psychologists, and therefore I could bring this entire picture.
Well, the cross-pollination between scholarship and practice is certainly one of the recursive themes on the podcast. There have been a number of, easily a dozen monographs on yoga, some aspect of yoga covered, And off the top of my head, the majority of the interviewees happen to be scholar practitioners. And so this comes up particularly, I think, in yoga studies, but in various subfields of Hindu studies. And to my mind, it seems that certainly there are practitioners who are uncritical, and certainly there are scholars who are perhaps insensitive or aloof or detached. But they're not, these categories, to my mind, are not mutually exclusive. And when done well, what do we have? We have we have a maestro. We have a musical virtuoso who really understands music history and music theory as well. It's, they're not mutually exclusive. When done well, I think they're mutually informative modes, as long as one understands the difference between the two lenses. So provided that the scholarship is good, and the provided, you know, the various elements are in place for it to be rigorous and critical and thinking and empirical where possible, direct experience will only enrich the study, it seems to me, in my particular opinion. But of course, there are many opinions, and everyone is welcome to their opinion on the podcast. So yeah. I really think that hybrid stance, it's burgeoning. It's burgeoning at the academy, and it's burgeoning. It's growing. It took me quite some time. I teach online. I've taught online for, I don't know, 5 to 7 years. Only in the last year or two have I been able to found a school. And it's taken me ever to figure out that the students, the ideal students, are practitioners who are also very heady and want to know the scholarship as well. So it seems to me the world is changing, and there are a great many people at the academy and beyond who want that cross-pollination. Yes? I wonder, the people that you refer to, or the phenomena that you refer to, how do I phrase this question? For whom is the Western psychological complement necessary? For whom? Who in particular needs that to complement their yogic quest? Would you say
this is for people who've been practicing yoga and meditation for a long time and still experience reoccurring patterns of behavior that are on the verge of being compulsive, that are intense, that whenever they act out in big, in a big way, an intense way, and that has serious consequences for their life and others. And this can happen. It depends on their understanding of yoga and meditation. But this is the book. This is where it is too intense when it takes such a long time to resolve issues of anger or jealousy of self or self-sabotaging, or walking in the world with a sense of being a victim, etc. So these serious issues or traumatic experiences that people had, events that people had, that merely by sitting in few sessions of meditation, it's not enough, because once you are out of the meditation, what we have deeply in our psyche is what we call samskaras. And samskaras are a dormant mental imprint that were registered or etched into our mind as a reaction to an event. And it is dormant. And it is dormant in a sense that it is transparent and we do not really see it. For example, we can see it now. Some person can sit in his room listening to beautiful music, relaxed, and everything is wonderful. But then that person can get on the road and drive, and someone may overtake him without indicating. So, you know, our person who drives can be immediately be triggered. It means that he had the samskara inside, that the circumstances have triggered it and caused him to act out. Like he can yell and scream and say a few words about nasty words to the other person, etc. Sometimes I heard into radical cases where people got into violence on a place of parking. So this is the samskaras. But And what I offer also in my scholarship, talking about samskaras, many speaks about samskaras, but they do not speak about the content of samskaras. What is a samskara, basically? Beyond the definition and the etymology of samskara, there's no a real discussion about samskaras in terms of the psychology. Anyway, through the books that I read, I didn't see it alive and connected to our daily life. So in my book, I bring it to life somehow through reading into the literature. Like, let's say I took Scrooge from Dickens' story, you know, Christmas Carol. I took him as a protagonist, as a figure, a profile on which I do all this analysis of samskara, vasana, and klesha, and then how we practice the opposite through the night. So this is an example, or I take different case studies and I explain that. If you'd like me, I'm happy to elaborate on that.
Sure, you can feel free to. Another question that comes to mind is, would you say that this need to complement the yogic quest arises because of the different setting that individuals are engaging these philosophies while in the world, while engaged in particular vocations and relationships, and perhaps in its original context, these philosophies were among the cloistered, among those who were removed from the world. Would you say that that relationship or placement in the world is what requires this additional psychological work?
I find myself in an awkward place, because if I say that there is a need for Western psychology, what it implies that the dharma, that the path of yoga is insufficient or is lacking something. And so for me, I can't say that. I think and I believe that the dharma path, whether in a cave or in life, is a full, profound path and complete in itself. However, when I speak about Western psychology, it is just a notion of, I'm speaking about the long term and the short term. The Dharma is good for the long term if we believe in reincarnations, etc. But if we are existentialists, and also practitioners of yoga, and for us what exists is just right now and this lifespan, okay, so Western psychology would be really helpful. So this is where this is how I relate to that.
One of the most fascinating aspects of the argument you're making actually pertains to various coaching conversations I've had. I have clients who come to me for what we would call personal growth issues. There may be relationship issues, there may be career transition issues, there may be blocks, particular setbacks, patterns. And more, there are folks who actually are coming for spiritual purposes, textual exegesis, practices. Time and time again, I say that personal growth and spiritual growth need to complement each other, because I met a great many people who are quite advanced spiritually but caught up in their teenage or their youthful emotional baggage. And really, they have astonishing wisdom and abilities even, and yet they've got these patterns of perhaps envy, perhaps issues, insecurity that haven't been worked through. And yet I've met other people who may be business people, who may be more mundane-oriented people, and they've done so much work on their personal growth and their psyche that they've necessarily become attained a more spiritual outlook. So it's interesting to me. In my mind, I think of it as the complementarity between what I think of as personal growth and spiritual growth. So I just wanted to share that random, those armchair reflections. Mm-hmm. What is this a line of thought that you're developing? I mean, is there additional work in this area, or is there something that you're sort of finished with now?
I've developed. Yeah, I continue to work with the psychology of yoga in a different context. But I just would like to go one step back with your permission. So
absolutely,
I may tell you about a case study how these three layers of psychological framework takes place in Patanjali, for example. So let's assume, and this is a case study that I read in a book by John Wellwood. Anyway, he speaks about a lady in her 40s that goes to her guru and tell her gurus that at home she's extremely frustrated with her husband, with her marriage, and she doesn't know what to do. She's bursting of anger from within, but nothing comes out, nothing is being expressed or being acted out, but she wants a way out of it. Not out of the marriage, but out of this frustration and anger she feels inside. So he tells her the classical instruction to be friendly, to be kind to him, to show kindness and warmth. Anyway, two weeks later on, she still feels even angrier. You know, it's like a person who's trying to sleep and trying to impose sleep, and the more he tries to impose sleep on himself, the more aggravated he is and agitated. So, and then she's going to see John Wellwood, who's like a 30 years a Buddhist practitioner and also a clinical psychologist. And then there is a story from her childhood that whenever she was angry, her father would slap her on the face angrily and would send her to her room and would tell her, don't come back out of your room unless you are collected and composed and smiling. So I was asking myself, what out of that experience, what samskaras, what possible mental imprints were etched into her mind, which she's not aware of? So the possible samskaras would be, when I'm angry, I'm not loved. When I'm angry, I'm not safe. When I'm angry, I'm not wanted around. And this is what she has internalized. And her, in her 40s with her husband, she cannot really express that because she doesn't want to risk his love. She doesn't want to risk the sense of belonging. So this is where she is at. Now, these are the samskaras. These samskaras are dormant and latent. We are not aware of them. We are aware only of the symptoms of it. So above that, there is that layer of vasanas. We call it the vasanas are patterns of behavior. This is the next layer that Patanjali is speaking about. So we can see immediately looking at this kind of samskaras, what patterns of behavior such a person will develop. Okay? So we'll see that person will be a pleaser, that person will seek all the time to satisfy the environment just in order not to risk that sense of belonging or affection coming out of people. Now, so these vasanas have about five ways of expressions. We call it the kleshas, which are causes of affliction. So the two obvious ones, which is raga and dvesha. So such a person will be attracted to situation where he doesn't need to confront anyone. Everything is nice and harmonized, okay? And a person will reject any sense of confrontation or risking that connection and love he has in his life. You can say that about every person, but for that person, this is his psychological network. And then there is this notion of asmita, which is the sense of I-amness. This is the I, I am. We add to every sentence, I am angry, I am attracted to this, I am rejecting this. This is how our ego solidifies. And then when we are in a state where definitely we do not see situations the way they are, it means that we are in some kind of, there's some obscuration in our life. We do not see things the way they are. And then there is always the fear of death as abhinivesha, underneath, pushing. So you see how these three layers work within life of the 21st century practitioner, how they manifest. So this is something which I wanted to explain, how we can name a samskara. we can give it an identity sentence and relate to that.
Yes, it seems to me anyhow that yogic psychology, if you will, can be quite a useful tool for approaching, for mapping, for understanding human behavior. Could you say a bit more about what you talk about, the first sort of inkling you had to do this work? You also mentioned it in the book where there are folks who had attained spiritual experiences or studied, but then returned to their lives and were sorely disappointed that the behaviors, their glaciers, if you will, or their behaviors were very much alive. Could you say a bit more about that? I think that's an important point for the basis of your research.
Yeah, well, what I can say, like as an umbrella kind of an argument, that these people who touched the peaks of meditation and came back to the West, what happened is that they had samskaras, they had their dormant mental imprints that were there and were not resolved, were not attended to. And when they came to the West, what happened is that these samskaras were triggered. It is in the same way that, you know, you take a seed, and if you put it in the right soil with the right light, right water, it will germinate. So in the same way, they came with some seeds in the psyche that they were not attended. And when these seeds met the right circumstances, they germinated and caused these people to act out. And yeah, so I can speak of various testimonies from the book that everyone can read. But one of them is that, you know, a person after 12 years having these wonderful experiences came back to the West. And in the first two years, many people were attracted to him because obviously there was something beautiful and clean and radiant about his appearance. And then in these 2 years, he had a group of students, he taught meditation, and then he decided to open two businesses. And he opened these two businesses and he entered into this commercial world that was draining his interest and his were attracting his interest and draining his energy in terms of the energy that he wanted to dedicate to teaching. And before he knew, he was locked into business difficulties, how of running the business. He had a partner and the partners, you know, were stealing money. And before he knew, he found himself without the resources, disappointed, upset. He divorced his wife because these economical difficulties actually also triggered the harmony or challenged the harmony he had with his wife. And they divorced. And so this is an example. Instead of using that empathy, that love, or the clarity, you could see that it wasn't enough.
One thought that comes to mind, it's been a number of years since I looked at the Yoga Sutras, but if I'm not mistaken, there is an aphorism about toasting the seeds, burning the seeds.
Yeah.
And so one wonders, just for the sake of argument or just intrigue, interest, one wonders if the folks who had the experiences, one wonders if whether or not they reached the zenith of potential. Because if I'm not mistaken, and I could be mistaken because the Yoga Sutras are certainly far to my area, my primary area is the Puranas, in particular the Devi Mahatmya. I work on the epics as well. If I'm not mistaken, at the level that Patanjali is speaking of, the seeds are toasted such that if you were to return to mundane life, there wouldn't be a trigger. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's one thought that came to mind.
Yeah. I mean, I'm totally with you. However, this kind of statement for me belong again, which is true, However, it belongs to the what I call the long term of time. This is for the long term. This is where you can achieve it. Because basically the paradigm of Patanjali is when you practice yoga on all its branches, not only psychology, but on all its branches, whenever you practice, you create positive samskaras. He calls it the Nirodha samskaras. And they are positive samskaras in the sense that they induce peace in our mind. They induce clarity, peace. They induce stillness in the mind and restraint of mental processes. So what is happening is that if we'll take the metaphor of seeds, so what is happening, let's assume you have what we call the negative samskaras, those that create psychological issues and mental issues. He calls it Vyutthana samskaras. This you can read, I think, in Sutra 50 in the first chapter. So he's saying that this heap of Nirodha samskaras, the positive samskaras, will grow and develop and will outdo the other heap of negative one. It will outdo that. Some commentators translate the sutra that this heap of positive samskaras will eradicate the negative one, will nullify the negative one, will cancel. So they use different name. I would just say they will outdo, because the samskara are still there, but they're then become parched. They decay. They become parched, these seeds. So in terms of Patanjali, definitely this is the paradigm of yoga. And I mean, all I can say, I believe that this is what it is. And again, for me personally, it relates to the long run. I don't want to wait until I reach that point so the negative will be dissolved. Because until then, I live with people. I live with the people I love. I have colleagues. I have psychological issues that I want to resolve. So I don't want to wait until then. I want to do something now. And this is why I attended the practicing the opposite, Pratipaksha Bhavana, which he mentions in Sutra 234, if I recall. And I developed it to a way that I can practice it on a daily basis and telling myself and others, if I hit a wall, I would go and seek the help of whatever psychology can offer me today. But I continue for the long run on my dharmic path. This is my statement here.
Now, this practice of Pratipaksha Bhavana, it's an important part of your book, and also it's an interesting part of Patanjali's theory. Could you unpack that or explain that for the listener? What does that mean, Pratipaksha Bhavana?
Yeah, Pratipaksha Bhavana means thinking or practicing the opposite. So Patanjali says that when one experiences anger as an expression of aversion, you know, I spoke earlier about the five kleshas as an expression of aversion. Of if one experiences jealousy as an experience of attraction, because you are attracted to what another has. And if you experience delusion in terms of you do not see reality the way it is, which is that klesha of avidya. So if you experience one of these three, you should practice the opposite. And then, because the sutras are highly condensed verses, every word there you have to depict. So he's saying, if you experience these three situations in three levels of intensities and in the three times, past, present, and future, so we have it, you know, three by three by three. This sutra covers 27 modes of appearance of the kleshas, okay? And then if something like that happens, so you should practice the opposite. And then the question is, what does it mean to practice the opposite? And what does it mean for the 21st practitioner, 21st century practitioner as well? So I went and explored what modern commentators said, what New Age commentators said, what traditional commentators said. And I can click on each one of them very quickly, if it's okay.
Sure.
For example, there is the famous guitarist Carlos Santana, who spoke about practicing the opposite. And he was saying, the moment you feel angry, just remove yourself and sit somewhere and start repeating some affirmation, saying, I'm patient, I'm patient, I'm patient. So what came to mind is that in the midst of anger, it's very difficult to extricate oneself out to start with. And if you have been extricating out of that grip of that emotion, so to repeat this affirmation, to repeat time and like it was a mantra, it is not enough. It is not enough. This is my answer to the guitarist. Why is that? Because, and here I approach again the research of psychology, and they were saying that repeating affirmation will not be helpful for the people who need them most, okay? Because for being able to cultivate patience, you have to have already some fundamental seed of patience for what you say to resonate and to connect to what inside. So it means that you have to have already some scar of patience, a positive one, from which what you say to ground you and anchor you into that. It's like, and people that do not have it, the moment they're trying to cultivate it, they will be even more agitated. It's like a person who feels failures in his life, and then you ask him to say, oh, you're a success story. So they will feel like they are betraying themselves. They will feel already the dissonance. They will feel that friction in a conflict that will cause them to be even more agitated. So I'm not saying that affirmations are good. They're very good. They can enhance a situation for someone, but I'm not sure whether they can heal fully. And like a person with for example, which has a low self-esteem. And this is based on the psychology research. And then there is another person, Ramamurti Mishra, who wrote a book about the psychology of yoga. And then when he writes about the psychology of yoga, he's a traditionalist, and he speaks about Pratipasha Bhavana in the language of suppression, in a language of imposing a new behavior on the old one. And when you approach this research, I've read a meta-analysis psychology research. Their findings were very clear that suppression is not conducive, not to the body, not the mind, not to blood pressure, not to cultivating new behaviors, etc. However, I don't go to the extreme, and I would still say, well, to a violent person, yes, you have to suppress your motivation or your drive to be violent. So yes, suppression is still very important. However, this is not what I believe Patanjali was leading. And here I'm trying to think with the text, okay? So then I've approached a modern commentator, and the modern commentator spoke about it very intellectually, in the sense of you have to inquire what caused you to behave in the way you behave. It's analytical, it's intellectual, and it is a very good step to self-understanding. However, intellectual understanding in most cases is very dry, and it takes time to absorb this understanding to cause us to change our behavior, okay? And then I approached a classical commentator. His name is Vyasa. He's the commentator from the 5th century, and his definition of Pratipaksha Bhavana is the closest one to which I identify with and support. He's saying to practice the opposite means to actually think about the consequences of your actions. Merely to think about the consequences of your actions to see that the result of your actions, this is good enough to extricate you from the grip of these clashes. But then, as much as I agree with Vyasa is saying also, he's not speaking about the consequences of our actions as hurting someone, hurting ourselves. This is not his main emphasis. He emphasized a very religious approach or belief that if I'll cause harm to anyone, I will be reborn in hell. I will be reborn as an animal, or I will suffer an illness, etc. But then bringing it to the 21st century, I said to myself, I don't want to act out of fear. I want to act out of understanding and through healing. This is what I want. And then I asked myself, how do I bring Vyasa's approach to the 21st century? And then I felt inclined to elaborate on that. And I felt that the first step would be to take is self-honesty. A self-honesty that, first of all, to admit to oneself and to others that I was taken by my pride, I was taken by my temper, and I was angry because of this and this and that, in a very, very, very honest way, in a radical, almost a radical honesty. And this I was taking after a research of a man named Stuart. He researched a monastery, a radical self-honesty practice in a monastery in the south of Egypt in the 4th century. This is where a junior monk will go to a senior monk and will pour his heart and mind to him. And the idea of this self-honesty is that when you behave in this way, your demons do not have where to hide. They come into light, so they cannot play tricks on you anymore. That was the aim behind that practice. So with that self-honesty, if you can admit, I was taken by my pride, I'm a yoga teacher, I cannot allow myself to come across as vulnerable, as this or that, so I have to take that persona. So all of this really invite just between us and ourselves, okay? But then this self-honesty is to go to what I call sensitivity. I don't want to call it empathy because empathy is a little bit selective, okay? But I would take empathy in a non-selective way, in a way where you really step and take the other's position in order to understand where he's at, what's going on for him, and then relate to him accordingly and appropriately. So this is more like the Adam Smith approach, general approach. And then after you have gone through that process of understanding through empathy, there's usually a feeling of remorse. There's a physical feeling in the throat because you understand that you've done something bad. And then there is that remorse that comes, say, oh, I don't want to repeat it. I don't want to do it again. But this feeling or this statement comes after this feeling of, you know, you feel the stomach tight or the throat tight. And then you say, I don't want to repeat it anymore. And then I took this practice and I found that bhavana in Sanskrit can be also imagination. And then I thought to myself, with imagination, learning from the story of Dickens, what happened to Scrooge, imagination can create a very vivid scene of the past. Also, you can see how you acted, your pattern of behavior in the past, in a very fundamental event or formative event in one's life. You can create the scene, you can see the body language, you can see the face of people. The face of people are so vulnerable, are so, they can really disclose, for most of them, the pain, the pleasure, everything. The body language can disclose almost. And then through relating to the body language, you can participate and relive the scene, relive what happened. And then you can, if it happened when you were 15, but now you are 40 or 50, so you can see it from a 40 or 50 years old point of view, through self-honesty, through the empathy, through the remorse, and start diluting in this way your kleshas and samskaras and vasanas. So you can take it into the future, because you know your patterns of behavior. You know how you behave, like if someone has, let's say, social anxiety. So one can visualize a social event in the future. And one can view how people, you know, people disposition, their body language. And then he can see himself through self-honesty, through empathy, and through remorse. And through that, that can itself can start biting and diluting his anxiety. Not only that, he can, after diluting his anxiety, he can say, okay, how do I see myself in that environment? Okay, so this is the greatness of that exercise of Patanjali, which means, you know, the 3x3x3, the three level of intensities of our kleshas, the three different times, and the three major kleshas of raga, dvesha as aversion, and raga as attraction, and avidya as delusion or as obscuration of reality. And so this is an adaptation to the 21st century, relating to Dickens, who is considered by many as the first psychoanalyst that precedes even Freud. Yeah.
Thank you very much for that exposition and application of yoga philosophy. We're pretty much at time for today. Was there anything else that you wanted to touch on before we close?
Just do one previous question of yours. First of all, thank you for your questions, because they got me going in a good way. I really appreciate it. And thank you for sharing your own experiences, which also invited me to share.
You're welcome. That's my dharma as the podcast host. You're welcome.
Yeah. So about my next project, you asked that question. I just want to answer it quickly. My current project is about Viveka Kiati. Viveka Kiati is a discerning insight that occurs in the very advanced stages of meditation. And this is a moment of discernment between one's ego, but not ego in a Freudian way, but ego as agency, as a sense of I-amness, as a center of thinking and acting and executing actions. So discerning between that and the real self, the true self, which is spoken about in Indian philosophies, whether it is Purusha in the philosophy of yoga or
Atman
in the Advaita Vedanta. So, and this insight comes, I am not who I think I am. I am not the source of awareness, because this is what the ego does. It owns everything. It takes possession of everything. This is the I we add to every statement that expresses our mental and psychological processes. And so this is also, this is my current research. Actually, I might say that this book is nearly fully baked and written in Hebrew and in English. And here also I propose a model of meditation that can help us to cultivate it already from the early stages of practicing yoga and how to do it. And it's a proposed thing. And basically, when I proposed a meditation or like the Praktipaksha Bhavana, this kind of proposition, this is something that I have also practiced with students in various workshops, like, for example, with the Evam Institute. I've been teaching philosophy in yoga training programs. So I've taught them the psychology of yoga. So I've been trying it with people in a safe way. You know, I cannot take people. I'm not a psychologist. I don't want to take people to any traumatic events, but just to become acquainted with mild patterns of behaviors, something that doesn't, we are not that charged because of them. So this is also what contribute to my studies, this meeting and trying, and I don't want to say experimenting, but practicing it together with people and see how they respond.
Well, you'll have to return to the...
Yeah. So this is one project of mine, and okay, probably suffice. I have a few more in the pipe.
Yes. Well, I was saying you'll have to return to the podcast once that... loaf is baked. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much.
For those of you who've been listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Giddy Ifergan of Monash University in Australia, in the outskirts of Melbourne, I believe. Until next time, well, we'll be speaking, of course, on his brand new Equinox book, The Psychology of the Yogas. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the utility of yogic philosophy. Take care.